So Troy, the latest talking point out of Team DeSantis is that, you know, he's going to take off any minute now, any day now he's going to take off. And we have to ignore not only the national primary polls, but now we should also ignore the state level primary polls, which have been consistently showing Trump with even greater leads than some of his national primary, some of the national primary polling. And some of the states that have been polled were described previously as strongholds for DeSantis. You know, you're looking at southern states where he's supposed to be his strongest, places like Georgia, Texas, he's down, even Iowa. These were all states that were described as part of DeSantis' strategy, that he was going to have a good showing in Iowa. He was going to have a good showing on, what, Super Tuesday in the South.
Yep.
But all the statewide polling is reflecting either the same national trend in the primary or an even greater margin for Trump. I mean, obviously the northeastern states, Trump is even more dominant, but I just don't see where the math is for DeSantis to supposedly win this primary. You're seeing elected officials come out in his own state, members of Congress, we're seeing senators come out, we're seeing a whole litany of elected officials come out and endorse Trump. Where is the institutional support for DeSantis going to be? Where is the geography politically that DeSantis is going to take, going to draw from for his presidential campaign in the primary? I just don't see a path. Is he making a monumental mistake here?
I think he would make a mistake if he ends up announcing. I think that this has been a potential campaign that will ultimately not happen if he wants to preserve himself going forward. Now, you know, when's the first voting? 7 months? That's a lifetime in politics. And this would be a valid point if this were not basically the equivalent of an incumbent president primary.
Right.
If Trump were just like the kind of media front runner in like 2008, let's say, when maybe it's a little different, but it's such a defined field at this point.
Right.
So he really would need to take off in one of the early states, which is going to be Iowa. It's going to be New Hampshire. And he's 35 behind in Iowa, New Hampshire. So
where's the path? And then it also has to be said right now that nothing is going to get better for him as time goes on. More people are jumping into the race. We saw Tim Scott jump in, you know, as ridiculous as he is. People are now jumping in the race to take points away, primarily from DeSantis, because the Trump block is the least fungible block in the Republican primary.
Yeah.
Everything else is like they're peeling away at each other. And people are seeing this weakness. They're getting in. They're going to vie for a cabinet spot. They're going to vie for whatever position they can. And that's only going to continue as time goes on. And DeSantis continues to show he isn't ready for prime time. We even see donors, the main group that have been propping up his shadow campaign, even they are walking away from the table. I mean, the reasons they're citing are ridiculous. I mean, in my mind, there was one major donor that came out, said he was appalled at the 6-week abortion ban, and he was appalled at banning pornography in schools. I mean, that just goes to show the state of the Republican Party, that the donors think banning pornography in school is a bridge too far. I mean, that's how pathetic we have become as a party in terms of who's financially backing us.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that whether people like it or not, this is very much Trump's party.
Yep.
And anyone jumping in now is making a play for their political future, or maybe they're aiming for a cabinet post.
Correct.
DeSantis had a path of being Trumpism without or after Trump.
Right.
But if Trump's still in the race, then he can only still be Trumpism after Trump. And when I say Trumpism, I normally just mean Americanism and sort of the particular path that he has taken the Republican Party. The media has chose to just call it Trumpism. Okay. I kind of think that only helps him on some level with the key parts of the electorate that he needs. Because, you know, you look at the Republican primary electorate, we know that Trump in two elections now, not just one, but really two, he can get a certain type of voter out that the Republican Party before him could not get.
Yeah, the low propensity Trump voter.
Yep. And
then we see when he's not on the ticket, they have catastrophic defeats.
We have
without
two midterms
him.
That prove that.
Two midterms, a lot of local races, statewide races, and just goes to show the Republican Party has failed to learn anything, that they are begrudgingly, you know, putting up with Trump and Trumpism, but they refuse to accept it on a substantive level.
Yep.
And because of that, they're going to continue to spite themselves electorally, and they don't understand that the only future politically for the Republican Party is to embrace Trumpism, populism, however you want to describe it,
yeah.
and their refusal to do so and them actively working to subvert it, and I would argue through this DeSantis shadow campaign, is only going to weaken us electorally vis-a-vis the Democrats, and they're doing everything they can to spite us come the general.
Yeah, and I think it's notable that, like, I don't know where you were at. I know you started off more in the libertarian Ron Paul camp. I was incredibly Trump skeptic when he arrived on the scene, and he won me over time through performance and results. But what he did tap into was, going into the cycle, I was fundamentally dissatisfied with the entire conversation in American politics. I was disappointed with the Obama presidency, which I was a part of the first campaign anyway. And so I represent, on some level, that disaffected ancestral Democrat that is represented by the pivot counties in American life, 206 of them in 2016, which voted two times for Barack Obama and then voted for Donald Trump. And almost all of those counties, almost all of them, stayed with Trump in 2020. Yep. So it's not like he lost his coalition. The coalition largely was there.
And it grew. Strengthened in many ways.
It strengthened because he did better with black voters, especially black
Hispanics.
Men. He did better with Hispanics, way better. And then he did better with Asian voters. So yep. He's doing better.
The one demographic he should have tapped into more was the white working class. And, you know, you could blame Kushner. You could blame certain people who said, oh, where do they have to go? And then it comes back to, well, they don't have to go anywhere. They could stay home.
Yeah.
They could do nothing. And that hurts us. And that's a demographic that
yeah.
if we were to tap out in, say, the mid-70s, you know, we would win every election.
Yeah.
In the same way, we should be turning the white working class vote into what the black vote is for the Democrats, and we would win every election. What the Democrats have with the black vote, it puts them in a perilous position electorally, because any shifts there, even on the margins, could really hurt them.
Yeah.
And it's not a large enough demographic to sustain them perpetually. But the white working class vote is far larger, far more geographically spread out, and we haven't even fully tapped it out.
Yeah, I think there's room to grow in the rural counties across the country, especially in states like Minnesota, Wisconsin.
And exurban.
Yep, exurban. Room to grow, and if the whatever is left of the RNC wants to be productive, they could get on board with an early vote plan that targets those low propensity voters,
right.
So you can bank votes in advance.
And some state parties have, but the RNC has shown no leadership to taking advantage of these laws where they already exist, whether it's proxy voting,
yeah.
early voting, all these different things, mail-in voting. You know, if it's legal, use it. And then once you have governing majorities, then you could debate about how to restructure it. But until we get to that point, we got to play the rules of the game.
Yeah.
And once you win the game with those rules, then you can change the rules. But we can't try to change the rules before we win the game. It's yeah. a totally backward strategy.
And what's the biggest rule that's arguably changed is our Constitution says that our elections are a series of state elections. States have the major prerogative over setting their election rules. And that has really been subverted. And we've kind of, in the last cycle or two, had a federalization of elections in a lot of ways. And so we have to ask ourselves whether we're actually going to be a constitutional republic that specifies not just these rights, but also these things in writing on what states take the leading role in. Or are we going to be, as I would argue, the progressive left wants, a sort of unitarian country ruled from D.C.
Right.
And that's, I think, the growing conversation we're having. And
well, they want to turn all of the country into New York or California. They want to turn it into effectively a one-party state where there is no political competition, electoral competition, that they can, you know, pass through every type of policy agenda they want without consequences. And we see what one-party rule has done to New York City, to New yeah. York State, to California. And that's what they want to export to the country as a whole. That's why federalism is so important. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're facing a multi-front war here. And I know sometimes we talk a lot about the internal dynamics in the party, because I frankly believe we can't truly take on the left until we tackle the additional, you know, fifth column in yeah. our own party. And I see it right now. For better or for worse, through DeSantis. I mean, this is a astroturfed campaign. You know, they were online bragging about, you know, this crowd size that he got at Liberty University when all the students were forced to be there for convocation. And it's like how manufactured are you that you're going to brag about crowd size for an event where the students are forced to attend? I mean, it's just pathetic. And then when you call them out, they lose their minds. This is a campaign, and this is a candidate that cannot handle the slightest bit of criticism, either on the policy front, or on their comms strategy, on their campaigning tactics, nothing. If you call out anything, they freak out. They resort to their bot armies on Twitter. And that's why you see a lot of their influencers are really freaking out, because they realize they made the wrong bet. They came out too early for Trump. They assumed he was dead. They assumed he was not going to be resuscitated politically. And now they're eating their own words. And it's hilarious to watch. It's painful to watch, but you got to love the primary.
Yeah, I mean, there may very well eventually be a Trumpism after Trump, but as long as he's in the scene, there won't be.
Right.
And I'm actually a little bit skeptical that there will be after him if the RNC continues along their ways. I would say that win or lose, that this party has 4 years left to sort of figure out the shifts that it needs to make strategically, pragmatically, on some policies. I think policy is actually maybe the last place it needs to shift, because there's always a lot of rhetorical things that will be sent out to the base, but you're not, it's really more about action though.
Right.
You say these things, cool. A lot of people have said these things, but are you going to act on them? And I think that there is a lot of potential in a sort of populist led future Republican coalition, but this is the reason the book's called, the emerging populist majority, not the emerging Republican majority 21st century version.
Right.
That is the distinction in the book. Because I'm obviously...
This is not partisan. This is ideological.
It's ideological. It's philosophical.
And the populist movement is also taking over in many parts of the left and the Democrat Party.
Yeah.
To an extent. It's not the same parallel.
They reject and co-opt its momentum, though.
Correct. And the Republicans try to do the same with any grassroots movement. We've talked about this before with the Tea Party, with the Liberty Movement, all these different precursors to the current populist movement. But, you know, the biggest talk about DeSantis is electability, but then none of it is backed up by anything quantifiable. I mean, they just throw these things out into ether. And you've said this before. They use Twitter, they use social media as a way to project their wishes into the ether, but it's not backed by anything. They say he's more electable. You look at the RCP polling average, Trump is up big. And if you take out the outliers, like, say, Quinnipiac, that are horrible, and they have, you know, him losing by, you know, I don't know, 12, 15, you're talking about Trump a minimum up 2 in the RCP average without Quinnipiac and some of these outliers, probably up 5, 6. And all these polls show a national popular vote lead, something that Trump did not see in 2020 or even in 2016, this time or in general.
Yeah.
That points to a massive electoral win, and they're trying to protect that there's no path for him, even though he only lost by 40,000 votes last time. What do you mean there's no path?
If they listen to I didn't see it so much with the DeSantis folks, but the Twitter left cited the ABC ISPOS poll this last week that's looking at favorability. And
favorability does not determine elections.
No, and that's a terrible poll. And, if it was predictive, 2016 would have gone differently. We're both had negative favorability
means nothing. You could have a candidate with super high favorability, no name ID, will lose every
time.
Yeah,
and actually,
you could have a candidate with super low favorability, high name ID, win every time.
Trump's the opposite of Barack Obama in that President Obama was somebody that always had favorability to a relatively high amount, but his policies were never liked.
Right.
President Trump was the opposite. His favorability was always a lot lower. Right. But his policies were liked a lot more, and the results were liked a lot more. So the longer he governed, the better he did.
Right.
At the ground level.
Yeah.
Yep. But for COVID, he's getting reelected.
Right. Well, that's the other thing people forget. They act as if it was a normal election. 2020 was anything but normal. The circumstances domestically, internationally, the pandemic, the summer of love, you know, basically a color revolution. I mean, he was up against everything, and he still almost barely lost, and he was outspent even by a significant margin as well. So I think you've discussed this. We're going to see a repeat of a Grover Cleveland style election with two incumbents against each other. We don't really have a lot of data. We don't have a lot of historical analysis to go off of it to view how this will play out. But there's certainly a path for Trump, the best path that exists for the Republican Party. And if they want to seize upon that and take back control in a governing majority, then we need to circle the wagon. We need to end this nonsensical primary, get behind Trump and move forward. Until then, I fully support Trump and his campaign's effort to smash the opposition into oblivion vis-a-vis DeSantis.
I am fine with, I think it's important to have some semblance of a primary. Because I think crowning people is always a mistake, but it is a quasi incumbency election.
Yeah.
So, like, for instance, you got
bring on the debates. I can't wait.
I think it's important to not So I think Trump will largely not attack the people polling in single digits. Like, who's the Vivek guy?
Vivek has positioned himself for a cabinet role very well. He's been complimentary of Trump, defensive of Trump. You can tell what people are gunning for. I mean, look, I think he'll hit some of these low-level polling candidates if warranted, because some of their views may be repugnant. Nikki Haley
but
or whatever.
Nikki Haley's not going more than single digits.
She's going to lose her state. So, she's going to come in third place in South Carolina.
Yeah.
I mean, these people are, they live in a bubble. You have to really admire how delusional some of these candidates are, egotistical, narcissistic, how much they live in their own echo chamber, that they look at these polls and they think, you know what's brilliant for me to do? I should run and come in third or fourth place in my home state. DeSantis is facing losing Florida. I mean, do they understand that they face being the next Tim Pawlenty? It's true. Do you want to be that? No one remembers Tim Pawlenty. Why would they?
They remember an excellent Michael Bay produced announcement video. His campaign strategy trying to win the Ames straw poll.
DeSantis has been coming out with good videos as well. I mean, he's trying to now hit Trump on the on the Second Amendment, which I found laughable. He didn't even go to the NRA conference. And, you know, Mike Pence at least had the balls to go, for whatever that means, but he got booed. And Trump got cheered, in an extraordinary way. But, you know, DeSantis is coming out attacking Trump. At the end of the day, Trump, no red flag laws were passed under the Trump administration. They were passed in Florida prior to DeSantis, but DeSantis has already come on record supporting them. He now has supermajorities and he's refused to repeal them. So the DeSantis crowd does these really stupid things where they expose their flank from a messaging standpoint. They come out and they attack something, they attack Trump on something that they themselves are guilty of to an equal or greater extent.
Yeah.
And I don't understand what they're winning. They're not winning anyone over. Sure, Trump did things with the bump stock, he said stupid things, but it didn't actually lead to anything real or tangible. DeSantis did say similar things on red flag laws. It did result in legislative movement on the red flag law bans, and DeSantis also has an opportunity to repeal them, and he's chosen not to do so. So why in the DeSantis camp they are sitting there talking about these issues that they themselves could be exposed to? I view COVID in the same way. I think he's been totally delegitimized on the COVID front, because if you really examine the record, it's either neutral at best vis-a-vis Trump or some cases worse. So to me, he's really destroying this artfully created image of himself that his PR team have constructed, which Trump has praised. They said he has a great PR team, and it's true. But that whole image is now being destroyed through the process of this fake campaign that he refuses to launch. And they keep citing, he's down in the polls because he hasn't even announced yet. He is de facto running. Stop playing stupid with everyone. He is running. He is on this sham of a book tour that's making him look dumb. He is in the race and he is floundering. Him making some formal announcement isn't going to change anything. It's not going to be some inflection point that they think it's going to be. He's cratering. He's going to continue to crater. He went from being neck and neck to now in the teens, and he's going to continue to fall.
I mean, if I were him, I wouldn't go through with it, because you can still save face in the long run.
I think
people have short memories.
I think he's stuck.
But you referenced Tim Pawlenty. I think that's exactly, as much as I was like, shot at Minnesota, but that's okay, because that's exactly accurate. Tim Pawlenty was theoretically a really, really good candidate to take on Barack Obama in 2012. He doesn't even make it to the state of Iowa for voting. We end up going, Mitt Romney ends up being sort of a version of that.
Right.
And you see the result of it. Now, why would it hit Pawlenty been theoretically decent? Because of the, this is a guy who got reelected in a blue state. Well, we'll say purplish blue at the time, especially still purplish blue. But he won in a blue wave year reelection by more, which reminds me a lot of DeSantis barely winning, and then winning by
a bisexual meth head in 2018.
And then winning by a lot in re-election.
He was also down in the primary.
Yeah. And so on some level, I would argue that Florida is just a fundamentally Republican state.
Yep. We've said this before. He inherited an electoral environment that any Republican or conservative would be envious of.
Yep.
It's certainly not something that Trump had at the national level, not even close. He inherited very healthy majorities in the state legislature in 2018. Those majorities grew every succeeding election cycle to the point that he now has supermajorities. Yep. He inherited a state that was already shifting right long before he came into office. He inherited a state that Trump pushed effectively to the right. He inherited a state that that he had the electoral environment that he needed to effectuate a policy agenda that in many ways Trump could not replicate with the cards he was dealt at the national level. And look, good, he's done good things, he's been a decent governor, but I think a lot of people with any political sense could have replicated the same thing DeSantis has done with the same environment he was given, an environment where legislatively he was dominating and an environment where electorally it was moving in his favor. And that shift can largely be attributed to Trump, who outran him as far as the raw vote totals when he had less money to spend in both elections.
If I were to say this, here's how I'd play it. I would not run. You're governor. You finish out your term by 26. And then you can run without having a job.
Yep.
It's perfect.
Yep.
And you have money that you could probably parlay into that already.
Right.
And people's memories are short. If he runs and makes it worse, he will never become president.
Yeah, I agree.
He still could if he elects not to run.
The window for him is shrinking by the day.
Yeah.
And sadly, I think his people around him are keeping him very much in a bubble, and he doesn't really understand what's at stake. He's getting bad advice. He's taking bad advice, which I all think, you know, people attack Trump for his personnel decisions. They attack Trump for his, you know, feedback loop not being solid. DeSantis is showing that even the campaign, his feedback loop is trash, and the personnel he has picked to advise him are also giving him horrible political advice. So, but enough on DeSantis. Yeah. I mean, I want to focus on a few other areas, either domestic or internationally. We saw recently it does tie back to DeSantis, the 6-week abortion ban. I mean, what do you think?
I
give him props for it. I give him props. I think that's exactly what a Republican should do when given a legislative majority. You know, you don't necessarily have to run on it or message on it. We can discuss those tactics. But once you have the governing majority, these are the exact types of things you need to push through. So if I'm going to give DeSantis praise before we move on, I will say good on him for passing that ban and for signing it.
Well, I think it's going to have to go state by state. And it's going to, what is important going forward? The pro-life movement got the win that they've been waiting for 50 years. And where do you go from here? You can do a politics first approach and just put it in law and let it play out, or you can have a culture first approach. And the victory recently was a culture first approach over the course of many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I think it still has to be at least a pragmatic / culture first approach.
Well, it needs to be combined with natalist policies.
Yes.
If you were going to come out and be anti-abortion and pro-life, you need to also pair that with, we're going to give baby bonuses, we're going to cover the cost of childcare,
yes,
we're going to potentially do maternal leave. I mean, there could be a litany of things you do to support families, to support mothers, to support childbirth. And if you want a pro-life policy agenda, it needs to be holistic. I'm obviously very, very pro-life. I'm very anti-abortion. But we need to go the extra step. What are you going to do to support mothers? What are you going to do to support families? What are you going to do to incentivize family formation, which is a voting bloc that votes overwhelmingly for Republicans? And we've discussed this before.
And could get even more Republican.
And could get even more Republican. And it could even grow. We've discussed this at length, that the left identifies their voting blocks, rewards them, and incentivizes their growth. They identified that female hyper-educated cat women are their best voting block. So let's make sure everyone is overeducated and they have multiple cats and no kids.
Yep.
Those people will vote for you. They understood that if we flood the country with immigrants, those people are illegal or legal. Those people will generally vote Democrat. So they're incentivizing that population growth.
Not as much as they thought, though.
Not as much as they thought, but they've largely moved on and beyond persuasion politics.
Oh,
they are
totally
not in the business of persuasion. They are not in the business of winning people's hearts and minds over on policy successes or on the substance. Well, they are just interested in creating an electorate either through internal incentives or flooding the electorate with other people that will vote for them, including pardoning felons or allowing felons to vote. Republicans should do the same. So if we're talking about the pro-life agenda, incentivize families, incentivize people to own homes, incentivize small business creation, and that will be your path to generational political dominance.
Absolutely, but there's one area that I do think they're trying to persuade. It's where you're impressionable, and it's education.
Oh, absolutely.
And this is why
I would call that indoctrination.
That's indoctrination.
Yeah, it's not even persuasion.
It's not persuasion because you're a kid. And it would be one thing if it were just this is our MO, but the pushback on and the attempt to label the parental movement and calling them all sorts of names Calling them like some sort of fascist conspiracy.
It's Maoist. It's Maoist.
It's complete Maoist.
Separate the child from the father. Separate the child from the mother. The child is only obedient to the state, to the ideology, to the cause. It's sick. It's creepy. And we see it play out in all sorts of facets with the radical LGBTQ agenda, the transgenderism, the porn in schools, all these things. They are trying to turn... They understand that a young mind is very impressionable and moldable, and if you could just turn it to mush, if you could take a person, strip them of all identity, strip them of all sense of past and present, yeah. and just turn them into some sort of atomized, mush-brained foot soldier to be your useful idiots, that is the path to the revolution. And this is how they take things over successive generations. They make you dumber, they make you more dependent, they make you more confused, and they make you less and less identified with concepts and values that elevate you, whether it's the church, whether it's the family, whether it's the nation. Now you're just becoming an atomized, secularized consumer.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's all you become. And that's an easy population to take over, combine it with drugs, combine it with the destruction of your communities. You know, you have a recipe for societal change, which we have seen rapidly over the last, generation or two?
Yeah, it's escalated dramatically the last 15 years, last 10 years. And I would argue it's just an escalation of Paul Harvey's famous Freedom to Chains speech. If you haven't ever heard that, check it out, because it is exactly, and this was why I love this speech, is it was said in the 60s. And so it anticipates a lot of the, he's definitely responding to the problems of his era, but he's anticipating everything we're dealing with today. And, but basically I look at the education stuff and that the Republicans basically have to hold the line, but I'll put it more broadly, ideologically, philosophically, conservative, patriotic, populist, pro-America, America needs to hold the line on education, on immigration, and elections.
Yep.
It holds the line on, I would say, even two of those three pretty well. That's a solid place to be in. Education, I think, has the most current positive momentum.
Electorally.
Electorally. You see parents are realigning more and more and more. We said this in a previous time, but I'll reiterate it again. Married men, 20% Republican in the midterms. Married women, 14%. That's not really a gender gap, or what one would associate with the gender gap when you're a married couple and you're really only 6% behind. That's not really a gap at all. Where the gap shows up is with single people. Unmarried men went 7% Republican, and then unmarried women went 37%. You described it. Say the cat lady caucus, if you will.
And they look at that.
And so I was taught, I will say that to someone, usually say that to kind of somebody who's more purplish or moderate or somewhere in the middle, or just frustrated with all of the conversation that's going on, kind of casual politically, which is my favorite conversation to have, actually, just to see where they're at and how they can be galvanized into getting behind a program and a vision and a path. But they will say that, oh, so you got to do better with that 37. I'll even say this to a hardcore Republican partisan. Well, you got to do better with that 37. Like, I would argue, no, we don't want to do worse. Don't want to do worse than 37, because that's bad. But I think taking that unmarried men from 7 to like 20 is the key.
Right.
So if we
need to replicate their margins that they have with their constituent groups for our constituent groups. The problem is we have not maxed out our constituent groups.
Yep.
They have maxed out their constituent groups.
It's all math. It's not like there are more. There are like the world is 51% men, 50% men, 50% women. And, you know,
we have just not done a good job. And again, this goes back to Republican Party leadership. It goes back to the low propensity voters. It goes out to how you're going to turn out these voters when they have low enthusiasm, when they're kind of on the fence. Well, then you make it easy. And the left have realized that. They realized that they had a far bigger enthusiasm gap for most of their elections. They couldn't get their people to come out to the polls.
Yep.
So what do? They bring the polls to them. All right, we have similar issues on our side. So now that they've opened the door for this, we have to replicate it.
Yep.
It's just about using these ideologically neutral tactics politically and electorally to our advantage, where they're allowed, where they're feasible. Use it. We're bringing knives to gunfights, and it's stupid. We do this constantly. I talked about this before with you. But moving on, beyond some of this electoral domestic front, we had a leaker.
Yeah,
he was
E3.
Yeah, E3. you are you're a vet. So what do you think about this whole thing?
Well, there's been many leakers in the last, you know, going back to Snowden.
Right.
Whether it's out of national security, there's been a leaker out of the military before.
Who was that trans one that was a leaker?
Not Bo Bergdahl, but Chelsea, what was it, Brad Manning? Chelsea Manning, who then I think ran for Senate or something briefly. I don't know if that actually made the ballot. But anyway, ordinarily, unless you have a very specific MOS, and E3 is not going to have access to that big, the stuff that was actually leaked.
It was mostly stuff we knew.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing.
It confirmed what we knew about what was happening in Ukraine.
Which is why that's not the story. Right. That's not the story. Right. Even though it really should be the story, because we already knew it, it's going to not be the story.
Right.
And they don't want it to be the story because it's negative towards the administration. Right. So the story is, let's kill the leaker.
Right.
So we're going to ostracize them and throw the book at them. So it's just another
version. And the leaker, was the name of the leaker again? I don't know. I just know
the rank was E3.
But he leaked it on like a Discord. He leaked it on like a Discord channel to his friends.
Yeah, like a gamer Discord.
I mean, he wasn't smart about it at all.
No,
I mean, had he gone to the press, had he gone through some channels that, were more legitimate.
He would have just sent it to Congress.
Then he probably would have been protected as a whistleblower. But he just did it in this sloppy, childish manner. I'm not even sure if it was ideologically driven, if he was really trying to expose anything, or he was just trying to show off to his friends.
Yeah.
I don't know. I am, to an extent, glad he did it. And I do think he should still be protected because these things should come out to the public, because the broader point here is that we are engaged in a fruitless proxy war in the Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia, where we are wasting American treasure and blood on a unwinnable proxy war that is completely detrimental to our national interest.
It's the equivalent of an undeclared war, yet another undeclared war, but it's traditionally with undeclared war, and it's not even an undeclared war from our standpoint,
When was the last time we declared war?
Well, you see, McCarthy made that tweet that this war is, he used the word war in his tweet.
Right. It is a war.
Right. Yeah. Right. Legally, it's not a war because we haven't declared war, and neither have the Russians. I think they call it a special military operation.
But it's not even under the AUMF that covers the war on terror. It's not that.
Right.
So
it's even more in a gray area.
So it falls under technically the War Powers Act from 73, the act that Congress passed to try to rein in the president's ability to get to backdoor into a war through the administrative process by the Gulf of Tonkin. Right. Escalation that led to the Vietnam War full on breaking out in terms of our involvement. Prior to that, we had lost a couple hundred advisors, but in 64, 65, 66, Vietnam War really starts for real, and 67, 68, and it takes us a decade to get out. And that was why the War Powers Act was passed. And you can put troops in another country, but you have to notify Congress. And if they are still there within, I think, 90 days, hopefully we'll correct that if I'm wrong on that. I think it's 90 days, if I remember reading this from law school. If you do not have a war declared within 90 days, I mean, basically the president has to go to Congress for at least the Iraq War authorization equivalent.
Everything that's been done legislatively on this topic have been loopholes and backdoors to get us into war.
Yep.
I don't think we've declared war since World War II.
No, it's since World War II, yeah.
Yeah, World War II was the last time we declared war, and Congress can get away with these proxy wars, these wars where we waste tons of American money, resources, and blood for no achievable, for anything, we achieve nothing.
We will never really win a war we don't declare.
Right. They know at the end of the day there's no support for it, and they know that the second that the American people are really going to be directly footing the bill, either in terms of conscription or in terms of actually financing it through taxes rather than just borrowing and printing, then everyone would lose complete interest in these types of things. But because we're the reserve currency, because we could print the money, because we can borrow the money, we don't have to actually go to the people and tax them more to do these wars, and because we could fight using proxies and we could fight using other people's sons and daughters, we don't have to actually use conscription. Yeah. So the whole thing is just a giant house of cards that's waiting to pop. And maybe the Taiwan issue does pop it. I mean, let's talk about what's happening there with our giant semiconductor factory in China.
We have semiconductors. We're trying to reshore to two big plants that are opening up in Texas, but won't open up for a number of years still. You can't just prop this up open overnight. Maybe other.
There was a Twitter account that I follow called Fisher King, and he did a whole thread on this. And he basically said, you know, these elites, they basically gutted our country with this free trade agenda. They shipped all of our critical and strategic supply chains abroad for a cheap buck. They gutted middle America and left them without jobs, without an economy to sustain any sort of a middle class lifestyle. Yep. And then we get dragged into these foreign conflicts to protect these supply chains that we deliberately shipped overseas to make a quick buck for a certain segment of society when the remainder of the heartland was gutted economically and all the rest. And those guys in the heartland are now going to fight to protect the supply chains that used to exist in the heartland that used to employ them. I mean, it's a sick, twisted game.
It's a tremendous grift. It's why I think this essential paradigm, all of the issues that exist within this paradigm, which is a lot more than polling would tell you, it's why Barack Obama became president. It's why Donald Trump became president. It's why whoever will become president until it's done. And, you know, while it's a different part of the world, whatever one thinks about the individual merits of what's going on, it's the same story as before. Another conflict that we're backdooring and backsliding into. Funding, as far as I'm concerned, funding it to the extent that we have, to the tune of tens of $100 billion probably by now. That's the same thing as the how expensive Afghanistan ended up being, how expensive Iraq ended up being.
And look what China did during this time. They used all their money and built a massive high-speed rail network through their entire country. Meanwhile, we wasted all our money on building schools that ultimately got blown up in Iraq and Afghanistan, then rebuilding them. And we don't even have basic infrastructure in our own country. I mean, outside, the roads look like Kabul.
For us to build what some of the things that they built, I've had some of these conversations with friends, you know, like how true is it that China can just stand up a big project like that very quickly? And but I think about that. And I think about, okay, you know, they're a communist country or ostensibly totalitarian type society at least, but they can stand up something like that in a time that if we were doing something like that, I'm thinking about our system. It would go through years of this labyrinth bureaucracy, bureaucratic process.
And look,
California can't do it.
No one can do
with
it.
With this one party, who's going to do it?
But it's not like, just, you know, China. Tons of countries have basically surpassed us in things like infrastructure and other forms of development. I mean, the parts of Europe have done it. Other parts of East Asia. It's not just China. I get it. We can't always make the comparison to China because of their system. It's totalitarian. But I'm just trying to point out how much we have wasted and have seen nothing in return for it. I'm not saying that the best solution is to have the government build all these things. I'm not saying that's the best solution. I'm just saying that we have utterly wasted our money abroad and we have gotten nothing in return. And during that time frame, we have lost out in terms of all these different metrics, a competitive edge over other countries where we could have used a fraction of the resources we spent in Iraq or Afghanistan domestically to achieve 1,000 times more than we have currently.
That's why America First is a powerful slogan.
Correct.
And when I talk to people that don't like the America First people, if you will, I always tell them if you want them to go away, you can start doing America First policies.
Right.
And trust me,
this is all a reaction.
It would kneecap it.
This is populism is a reaction.
Populism is a reaction to elite mismanagement.
Exactly. Hands the down. Elites have become decadent. They've sold out our country. They've sold out our nation. To the highest bidder, they've gutted the country in many ways, and populism has emerged as a force. Trump was a reaction to a decadent status quo, and this happens throughout history. This is replicated throughout history, and if they don't like, you know, the rhetoric, if they don't like the fire breathers and all this, then they should be doing their jobs and they should be answering to their constituents and they should be looking out for the posterity of this nation and its people. And they should stop looking at everyone simply as an economic unit or purely in GDP. And they should start looking at this as these are real people, real individuals, families, communities that have been struggling, that have been left for dead, that have been totally looked over. And they are upset and they do not like that the country they are growing up in is not the country that they were promised or they remembered from the country they're living in now is not the country that they grew up in or that they were promised.
Yeah.
And that sentiment is not going to be changed by, you know, saying, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, you must be lazy, all the rest. I mean, we have an opioid crisis, we have a crisis of spirituality, we have a cultural crisis, we have an economic crisis, and these communities, these cities, these states have been completely destroyed under the boot of globalism and elitism. And the only solution, yeah, in my mind, is populism and common sense policy approaches that make sense.
Yes.
Reshoring our strategic supply chain, having some supply chain depth, you know, having some level of protectionism to encourage, you know, domestic businesses, you know, standing up for traditional values in this country, having a strong border to fight for the American workers so they have a stronger purchasing power, not a constantly diminishing purchasing power, you know, putting America first on the global stage so we're not fighting other countries' wars, we're not fighting the wars of outside interest, that we're only defending our national interest. I mean, these are common sense things. Putting the victim above the criminal.
Yeah,
punishing criminality, punishing barbarism, taking care of the chaos in our cities and streets. I mean, these are common sense approaches to a litany of problems facing our nation. And the response to us as populists for bringing them to the forefront is we are accused of being fascist. We're accused of being all sorts of nasty, totalitarian type people. And we're accused of, you know, stepping on the legacy of Reagan. You have all these people with such a confused jumble mess of an ideology. People like, what's his name? Matt Wiltshire from the Texas Young Republicans, who gets on this stage and doesn't even know what he's talking about. On one point, he sounds like a libertarian. Another point, he sounds like a Rockefeller style Republican.
Yeah.
And another point, he sounds like a neocon. He's like, I stand for the free market. That's why we need to support further spending of taxpayer money in Ukraine. That's why we need more corporate bailouts. And I stand for liberty. That's why I want to crush Americans under the jackboot of globalism.
It's what happens when you get people, and no offense, but I think whether you're a YD or a YR, you get a lot of people that like the idea of a political life and seeing their name in print. Very common person that comes through those doors. And they're looking at things, and maybe they've watched The West Wing or some other. They're doing an impersonation of what they think a politician should say.
And then
the elites are taking a look at all this and saying, we have a political crisis, and it's ruining the country. We have a political crisis. No, no, no elites, no dukes and earls. The political crisis is the last crisis to manifest itself. All these other crises happened and were going for decades and have continued to grow. And you were not accountable to them. You were
Correct.
Not listening. And when you have that paradigm, when you have that elite mismanagement, whether it's intentional or incompetent, doesn't even really matter.
Usually a mix.
Yeah, mix. That is when you get your political crisis. Your political crisis is the end crisis.
Correct. It's a symptom.
It's a symptom of everything. So what was the first crisis? I would argue kind of a cultural rot,
yep,
a morality rot.
Correct.
And I think that goes back to the breakdown and breakup of the family.
What year?
I think...
Decade.
I'm going to say the 1960s.
Yeah, I was going to say the same.
I could even go to the early 1960s and say, I'm still in the 1950s.
Right.
And I think a lot of the things that people like to cite of the 1960s that represents, oh, look at this. Well, even that stuff is the work of the people working in the 1950s in a pastoral family America.
People forget you inherit the wealth and the prosperity of the prior generation. So
yep,
you could be running on fumes for quite a while. And honestly, our yep country has been running on fumes for
even
quite a while.
Even my childhood, I feel like I was right still in that
correct
paradigm. Because I would argue the 80s and the 90s were a bit of a renewal.
Well, we did have a baby boom.
Yep.
There was a baby boom. There was
it's associated with literally that idea.
Correct. So there was a bit of a reversion. So not everything is always yep doom and gloom. And not everything is constantly a trend
yeah
downward.
So I would say it was like...
And then
now down.
And there were yeah a lot of opportunities that we missed to really unite the country, bring about a national consensus once again, and start governing effectively. I think 9/11 was one of those times.
Yep.
I think the end of the Cold War with the fall of the Soviet Union mm-hmm was another one of those times. I mean, we squandered every opportunity we were given,
yep,
geopolitically or domestically.
Yep.
And we burned through our national treasure. We burned through our resources. We've burned through... you know, political capital, if you will, in many senses. And because of that, we are now a declining power. And I think we're not declining in every sense. I think we are still, you know, supremely a military dominant power, but our quality of life domestically is going to start to descend to that of Argentina. We'll just have nukes and we'll just have aircraft carriers and we'll have all the military
tech. We'll be a nuclear silo, a Walmart,
and a
bunch of dilapidated,
some of the elements of the superpower will still
towns
be there. That's why,
yeah,
and I think Darren Beatty pointed this out. He said, you know, we're still going to be a superpower in many ways. And it's true, we will be a superpower. But the areas where we will really be suffering in is for the common people. It's for the average worker, the average family, the average Joe Schmo. They're going to be facing a lower quality of life as the decades go on. The United States, you know, empire and the military industrial complex will do well. But that's always the end stage of an empire. Well, look at the Roman Empire. I mean, it was the generals and the warlords and the political elites were still doing fine, and they were still the preeminent power in the world at that time. But the people themselves, their quality of life had deteriorated. They were facing urban squalor and, you know, all these other things I'm not going to get into right now from a historical perspective. But that carcass of an entity, the Roman Empire, dragged on until the fall of Constantinople, will drag on in some shape or form for a long time. Yeah. But the people themselves are going to suffer, and that's really what needs to be the distinguishing factor.
Well, I think right now we're in, I call it the Downton Abbey coalition, the upstairs, downstairs. New York City is the peak of that coalition, San Francisco, where you basically have no middle class, or if you're in the middle class, you're actually just either rich or struggling and paycheck to paycheck and quite poor. The middle class was always so important. Tocqueville knew this. It's the middle class is so important to
a republic
and this country in particular.
Same thing with Rome.
And it's always been true. And it looked like this land and the resources here and the geography we have just a great bountiful geography. And so a thriving, independent.
We're blessed with the land we have.
And that's why there's hope. There's always hope. As long as there's life, there's hope. You know, a quote from, I don't know who said that. I'm sure it's been said a lot, but it was in a movie the last 10 years, I think. But what does that really mean? They're throwing up your hands and quitting, which is a mentality I see a lot with Generation Z.
And the right. The loser right?
Yeah, the loser
doomers
right.
And gloomers, yeah. The people that want to accept the left's frame, they want to accept the nihilism, they want to just surrender.
Yeah.
They've already been demoralized, and they don't understand that half the battle is just maintaining your spirits and realizing that there's still a fight to be had. The enemy wins without firing a shot if they can convince you you have no ammo.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the left does half the time. It's projection. It's projection of strength that they don't have. It's weaponizing their extremely small vocal minority to topple regimes. And that's what they've mastered. They've mastered the art of taking that dissident percent of the population and turning it and projecting it as if it's 50%.
I think the real lesson of the 1960s was the realization that you could have a very vocal activist group and actually take down big entities or take down big ideas in the 1960s. And I guess I mean sort of the anti-war movement.
Right.
While in a lot of ways, I think our Vietnam policy was improperly placed within the Cold War paradigm. We should have gotten out a lot sooner. And Nixon, just like his former boss, Eisenhower, did get out. We did get out there. Two great men. And two incredibly smart men. Like, you just don't see that many smart political leaders these days. It's really sad. And you know, turn on any older video and you could see
the general IQ of the country has just declined tremendously. I mean, you just look at the average, average schmo on the street speaking generations ago. I mean, they are just light years ahead of the average person on the street today. And that just goes to a civilizational, societal decline that we have been experiencing and that has been slow and steady. It didn't happen overnight. We have been through a stagnation in many different fields and metrics for a long time. And we are now just sort of waking up in the idiocracy that we have been, you know, fermenting.
And I think this is probably the jump off point for the next episode, because I have a longer spiel to go on here on you, because you said, what's the start of this? Where's the origin of this? Unpacking that. And I think it is the 1960s.
We'll do a current events episode.
But I think there's a few more things to bring up along that trajectory.
You go back to Wilson. You can go back to the roaring 20s.
Could go back, but also what happens after the 60s is something I would like to bring up in the next episode.
Absolutely.
A longer unpacking. I'll hint at it. It's Watergate. But I don't really want to talk about the details of Watergate. I want to talk about everything around it.
Absolutely.
And what it represents.
I think that'll be a good next episode. Well, with that, I think we can conclude this. Thank you, Troy, and hopefully we'll have another great discussion soon.